can control any election. We are the majority of the population, the majority of people who are registered, and the majority of people who actually show up and vote.
Welcome to New Mexico and the Vote. I'm Megan Kamrick. This limited series podcast is a companion production to the American Experience documentary, The Vote, on PBS, which is airing 100 years after the ratification of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution that gave women the right to vote in the United States. The Vote is available for streaming at nmpbs.org. We've charted the path to ratification of the 19th Amendment here in New Mexico and those who were left out, even after women won the vote, Native Americans. On this final episode, we want to explore what is left undone. What is the work left unfinished for women's rights, for Native American voting rights?
Hi, my name is Atadon Chavez. I am a member of the Navajo Nation and was born for Kiwa Pueblo.
Atadon Chavez is executive director of the Native American Voters Alliance Education Project. She reminds us that historically there was a push in the state to not allow Native Americans to vote.
In our village, Kiwa Pueblo, we were told not to vote. And we were told not to participate. And so my father's grandfather said, you know, no, this is not acceptable. He stood for days in front of the tribal court for his right to advocate to be able to vote. And so in our family, since then, it's been a very, very, very big deal for us to make sure that our voice is heard and that we vote as our family, but also get as many people on board to vote. And my father, you know, he was the chair of the Native American Voter Task Force before he passed. And so there's this history of people trying to become engaged in this process. And unfortunately, so many of our folks feel disenfranchised, feel powerless. And this is one of those ways that we're able to kind of regain some of that power.
But exercising the right to vote continues to be problematic for Native Americans in this country. The Native American Rights Fund issued a report in 2020 called Obstacles at Every Turn that found Native Americans continue to face a wide array of barriers that are preventing them from voting and stripping them of their political power, including geographical isolation, poorly maintained or non-existent roads, technological barriers, and discrimination. And language is also a barrier. Under the Voting Rights Act, there are requirements for bilingual written election materials and oral translations, but the report notes jurisdictions have often failed to provide that assistance, forcing Native American voters to file lawsuits in Alaska, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. The coronavirus pandemic has exacerbated these voting issues in many Native American communities. Chavez says the Navajo Nation, which spans parts of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, has been slammed by COVID-19. This made voting in the 2020 primary in June much more difficult.
On the Navajo Nation, they had to close down a number of polling locations, as well as early voting locations. That contributed to a very low voter turnout percentage in both McKinley County and San Juan County, which have a lot of Navajo members that live in those counties. For the Pueblos, they had to decide whether or not they would keep their early voting locations open, because if they kept those locations open, New Mexico election law has it written such that they would have to allow any voters, even those who are non-tribal members, onto their lands to be able to early vote and use those polling locations. So a lot of these sovereign nations have decided to close their Pueblo lands. Because they closed their Pueblo lands to non-tribal members, this made keeping those early voting sites open very difficult. And some tribes decided just not to have the polling locations because they were dealing with so many members being affected by COVID-19. Every single elder person that we lose in these communities is like losing an encyclopedia, is losing a whole section of a library. So they were very, very, very serious about safeguarding their communities and safeguarding their elder members. But in Native communities, It's those early voting days and the days where they have all of the supports for voters, whether that's having someone outside to be able to bring in someone in a wheelchair or having a translator there. All of those additional supports that a lot of the tribal members make use of were not there. And so we, as a whole population, I think the voter percentage was just around 18% for New Mexico for this primary election.
What do you think that means for the upcoming general election in November?
It means that I have a lot of work. We all have a lot of work to do to make sure that we safeguard our community's right to vote. It means that we have conversations with the Secretary of State's office to make sure that we have things like drop-off locations. It's to make sure that we have those early voting days in a way that is safe for our communities. It means potentially changing that little portion in New Mexico election law stating that a tribal polling location needs to be open to every single person in that general vicinity.
Perhaps a larger and more complex issue for advocates like Atza Don Chavez is to convince the unconvinced that voting matters.
It's hard to engage in a system that continuously breaks you down. Mm. It's hard to put merit into participating along with others who continuously make it hard to live your life. And it's hard to see the other side of the coin where it's like, well, if I voted and I got my buddies to vote and I got my neighbors and my family to vote, that maybe all of us together could change that. So I think being able to articulate that message, being able to push that forward is going to be really what makes or breaks us with this coming generation. And at these peaceful protests, you are seeing dozens, hundreds of youth out there saying, this is not right. This is our world. This is how we want to relate to one another. And so if you can get some of that and you can get some of those youth who are saying, you know, this is our Mother Earth. This is, you know, what you're leaving to us. We don't want it, you know, bruised, battered, and unlivable. If you get some of those people engaged to realize that part of that solution is potentially voting, then I think that you can really get these people to become what we call like super voters, mm-hmm. who go and advocate every election season to get people out to vote, that drive their family members, that, you know, take their grandmothers and their grandfathers to go vote, that, you know, babysit for their aunts and their uncles so they can go vote. And that's kind of what we're trying to push. In New Mexico, we make up 11% of the population. Could you imagine how different our state would be if we had people who were mindful of our resources, of our water? I can't even imagine how different it would be, because you're looking at 15% to, you know, 35% of the population voting, and that is way too low. And then you think about it nationally, every single state, you know, they have their Dem and their GOP parties and any other third parties. They have all kinds of different organizations for everyone to get out the vote. There are only 4 states in all of the 50 who have something that advocates for Native Americans to vote: New Mexico, Montana, Alaska, California.
Chavez says it's also about getting more Native American candidates on ballots, such as Representative Deborah Holland from Laguna Pueblo. She and Representative Charisse Davids from Kansas won seats in Congress in 2016, making them the first Native American women to do so. Holland says everyone on her Pueblo is automatically registered to vote in tribal elections when they turn 18. And she recalls when she was on the election board at Laguna and they got the tribal council to shift to a mail-in balloting system for everyone in the tribal election. Participation nearly doubled.
I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people don't vote, but I know this. If we can remove barriers, any barriers to somebody voting, then we have a better chance of getting their vote to count, getting them out to vote, giving them a voice to speak in our elections. And so that's what I will always do to the extent that I can. And yes, things like automatic voter registration, same day voter registration, all of those things, those are going to help to remove barriers. And so I think we should just work toward those as much as we can.
So, more than 70 years after Miguel Trujillo sued to win the right of Native Americans to vote in New Mexico, there remains a lot to do to ensure that happens. 100 years after the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified, where are we now in terms of women's political power in this country?
Well, it's interesting where we are. We're everywhere and we're nowhere.
Martha Burke is a political psychologist, expert on women's issues, and a national consultant on gender pay equity. She's also the author of Your Voice, Your Vote, The Savvy Woman's Guide to Politics, Power, and the Change We Need. Over the last several decades, there have been surges of women running for office. That happened after the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court, when the nation watched a black woman face an all-male, all-white Senate Judiciary Committee and lay out graphic testimony of sexual harassment. It happened again recently in the 2018 midterms. Burke says we should see that as a positive upward trend.
Finally, after 100 years, it is starting to look normal for women to be in elective office. And there was a time not so long ago, you know, 20 years ago even, it wasn't all that normal. If you were a woman running for office, you were kind of like a dodo bird or something that we don't see very often. And now people just take it for granted. So I think that has definitely changed. And I think women's priorities in Congress change. It changed things. If you look at who introduces bills that would benefit women disproportionately, and I keep using childcare, but that's so huge. And it's huge right now because of the COVID-19 crisis. Women are losing jobs in greater numbers than men. At the same time, women are the majority of the medical personnel that are out there, restaurant workers, majority women. And so it's a double whammy. And I think women who are in elected office understand this better than the men do.
Women currently make up about a quarter of the House of Representatives and the Senate, the highest percentage in U.S. history. But Burke says women are still lagging in national policy.
But right now, if women would just realize it and vote our own interests, meaning things that are more relevant to women than men, unfortunately still, stuff like child care, maternity leave, that sort of thing, even Social Security, women can control any election. We are the majority of the population, the majority of people who are registered, and the majority of people who actually show up and vote. So in that sense, we're way ahead. But until we can get a critical mass in Congress and in other leadership positions, and we're moving ahead in governorships, we will still be behind on the policy issues because, let's face it, our priorities are just different from those of men in general.
How are women not voting their interests right now?
Well, it's interesting. When the vote was in controversy 100 years ago, the men were saying, well, women don't need the vote. They're just going to vote like their husbands anyway. So why give them the vote? But the other argument was, don't let them have the vote. They're going to overtake the world if they get the vote. Well, neither has happened. But women didn't vote substantially different from men until 1980. And that's when the ERA was before the states. Reagan was running for president, anti-ERA. Carter was pro-ERA. And for the first time in history, women voted differently than men. And it was named by, I think, Eleanor Smeal, who was at NOW that year, National Organization for Women. And she dubbed it the gender gap. And the gender gap has never gone away. And that means that women vote differently than men in general. Now, there are segments, as we know very much right now, things that are in the national dialogue, for example, outlawing abortion, which is up in 20-something states, I think, are working on bills hoping to get to the Supreme Court to overturn women's right to choose. And there are women in that movement that oppose women's right to choose. So we're not all together all the time, but in general, women are voting differently than men. And women, for example, if there's something on childcare that comes up, should we have childcare? Should we have universal health care? Women differ from men on those issues.
The American Experience documentary The Vote shows the enormous push against women getting the vote, with political cartoons demonizing suffragists and predicting all kinds of calamities. It tapped into fears that this would destroy the family and create chaos. It's not very different from some of the arguments used against the Equal Rights Amendment.
At the time, it seemed like a slam dunk that the ERA was going to be ratified and become part of the Constitution. And then all of a sudden, a woman-led but male-inspired movement stopped it. And it convinced women that they didn't need it, that it would be bad for them. They would lose so-called privileges, like the privilege to stay home and take care of kids instead of going out into the world. Well, that's very arguable. But at the time, women, a lot of women bought into it. And so did their husbands. And of course, the leaders of the movement were very feminine women. And that was by design as well, because they tarred the feminists with the lesbian militant label, and that stuck too. So I think it's interesting that the ERA has now been ratified by the number of states, 38, that are needed, but there's a backlash again. Some states have tried to basically unratify it, which there's no provision in law to do. But that just means women are going to have to fight another few years probably to resolve that.
Alice Paul, one of the leading suffragists in the early 20th century, knew that the work did not end after the 19th Amendment. Sylvia Ramos-Cruz is a retired doctor who's working to pass the ERA.
Even by 1920, she was already thinking that the right to vote was not enough protection for women's rights because it did not encompass all rights. So she wrote the Equal Rights Amendment. There were many women, even in the suffrage movement, who were not for that, because they look back on all of the victories that the labor unions, for example, have had, that the women in the labor unions have been able to secure some rights for their members, you know, maybe a little 15-minute break, maybe coming in a little late, whatever the rights were that women had secured within those really harsh working environments, the suffragists and really progressive women felt that maybe having this amendment that said everybody was equal would take those rights away from those women. And they had been, you know, hard fought. However, she was right.
The Equal Rights Amendment was introduced in Congress in 1923 and thereafter in every session until it passed in 1972. The text is pretty straightforward. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. The Congress shall have the power to enforce, by appropriate legislation, the provisions of this article. This amendment shall take effect 2 years after the date of ratification. But as the site equalrightsamendment.org notes, the ERA is a political and cultural inkblot onto which many people project their greatest hopes or deepest fears about the changing status of women. 22 states out of the required 38 ratified it the first year it came out of Congress, including New Mexico. But as opposition gained steam, led by conservative activist Phyllis Schlafly, that pace lagged. By the 1982 deadline set by Congress, just 35 states had ratified. Since that time, three additional states have voted to ratify, and there have been efforts in Congress to do away with the deadline that Congress originally imposed. However, five states have also voted to revoke their earlier ratifications, although it's unclear if that's legal. At least one poll by The Guardian found 3/4 of voters support the amendment. And recently, 93 companies, including tech giants like Google and Apple, showed their support by filing briefs in support of a lawsuit against U.S. archivist David Ferrero. It's his job to add the amendment to the Constitution. However, he has not done so because of guidance from the Justice Department. The corporations make a pragmatic business case for their support. Quote, "The socioeconomic and legal challenges facing women due to gender inequality directly impact businesses in their efforts to recruit and retain women employees and access new markets, making it harder for American businesses to succeed." But there are other voices who don't see a need for the ERA. because women have advanced and gained equality. Martha Burke disagrees. Every piece of progress women have made, she says, is statutory.
And that means two things. It can be overturned if the Congress is hostile enough, or it can be weakened considerably by provisions, by court challenges that wouldn't necessarily overturn it, but they could weaken it. One very good example right now is Title IX. Title IX was passed because women were being kept out of medical and law schools because they were women. Girls could not play sports in schools because they were girls. But Title IX over the years has been weakened by various rulings and practices. Currently, it is being weakened even further. It also applies to sexual harassment in schools. And the current education secretary, Betsy DeVos, is an anti-Title IX person. That's just one example of why, if you don't have fundamental equal rights in the Constitution, everything statutory can be changed or go away.
Advocates have expressed alarm about the revamped rules DeVos issued in May 2020 regarding Title IX that bolsters the rights of those accused of sexual assault. There are a number of lawsuits pending against DeVos and the Department of Education over the new rules. Sylvia Ramos-Cruz says the Equal Pay Act is another example. It was signed into law in 1963.
Do women have equal pay over 50 years later? We don't. We don't have equal pay. So then Lilly Ledbetter Act comes along. Okay, you know, that's more recent. But Lilly Ledbetter Act does not guarantee equal pay. All it does is guarantee that if you are discriminated against and you're getting less pay than your male co-worker who does the same work, and you find out within a certain period of time, you have a longer period of time to fight that and to appeal that. It doesn't say you have the right to get paid as he did. You have to, the longer period of time to appeal it.
Change, apparently, takes time. It's one of the many lessons from the suffrage battles of the past.
One of the biggest items that we can take away from the suffrage movement is that we saw women with tenacity who never gave up. You know, it took almost 72 years from the date that they started to the date that the 19th Amendment was actually signed into law and became effective. That's a long time for women to fight.
Pamela Herndon is the chief executive officer of the KWH Law Center for Social Justice and Change. It focuses on policies that foster the well-being of women, children, and families. She's working on a suffrage centennial celebration scheduled to take place in late August. As we learned in our previous podcast episodes and in the Vote documentary, suffragists were involved in all kinds of projects to improve society, even before they fought for the vote. Herndon says that tradition continues today.
So we are still engaged in these many, many, many projects that raise our communities as well as ourselves, because there's no one issue that can be resolved without all of it being resolved. And just let me give you an example. So if we look at the whole concept within the state of New Mexico, where we are the second, the first, the third, it depends on where you look on any given day, at the highest rate of domestic violence in the whole country. And so what if we work and we try to improve one aspect of it by giving women, let's say, money so that they can move forward and leave their abuser? But then you have a whole systemic aspect of the rest of their lives, like how do they get housing? How do they get access to good jobs? How do they get good childcare and that they can pay for? So that we can't just resolve any one item and say that it's been taken care of. There's a whole systemic group of items that have to be taken care of to lift these women up. So that whole concept still remains with women in general. So even if we go about an idea of saying that, oh, we're going to fight for equal pay, for example, but then if you get equal pay, what good does it do if you don't get equal access to the jobs? So to rise up on a managerial level, so that women are so multifaceted that we can't just focus on any one issue, because we have so many to make sure that equality is available to us in every aspect of our lives.
Like other advocates, Herndon is concerned that certain protections are being eroded, including protections from the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But she also sees cause for hope, and points to the 2017 Senate victory in Alabama by Doug Jones over Roy Moore, who faced multiple allegations of sexual misconduct. Joan's victory was in large part due to the support by Black women voters.
The good part about all of this is I'm seeing the strength of African American women voting and lifting up themselves as a bloc. And all I have to do is look at what happened with Doug Jones and his candidacy. And so as we look forward to the 2020 presidential race, I mean, we also see this whole strength of the African American women voting together as a bloc and standing together because they're looking for individuals who will be elected, who will advance their rights and causes.
However, some of the unfortunate parts of suffrage history still resonate today, and that includes divisions between white women and women of color. It has been a fraught history through the suffrage movement, into the second wave of feminism in the 1960s and 70s, and even the most recent women's marches around the country. The latest uprisings for racial justice are prompting many of us to examine our own internal biases.
You know what? I really think that's going to take, Megan, it's going to take an issue and a real conversation about sharing power. Because I think that when white women are looking right, getting out of that inferior status of women, and they want to move up, are they really, are white women and Black women really able to share power together? And so when you've both been disenfranchised in so many ways, and now you're both trying to rise up, how do you then make it work?
Herndon says her organization is also working on educating the next generation of voters to ensure they understand the history of voting.
Because many times, even when we look at history books, all of the aspects of what was missing from not being able to vote is not really brought out. So it's that history, that aspect that we need to make sure is told on a regular basis. And I think that it's up to our generation to make sure that that story is still told and to energize them. It's important to continue to tell that story so that our younger generations can understand the reasons and purposes behind voting, and to then let them see what you can truly accomplish when you vote and that your vote really does matter. And so we need to demonstrate it more and more as they run for offices in their high schools and in college to show them that you being elected to a position can make a difference on whether or not a woman is actually paid fairly, or if she's not paid fairly. If your sister gets a paid family leave when she needs to take care of your mom and your dad, and if she doesn't get it. But you are there, and you're there because there were enough people to make sure that your vote was counted. And so those are the stories that we're continuing to tell over and over and over. And I will just say to you that on August 26th, this year of 2020, when we get ready to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, our focus is also going to be looking at those 18-year-old women who, by the way, outrank, when I say outrank, they outnumber the number of men within our state. So ladies, you no longer need to ask. It's time for you to take what we need. Don't say, will you please give me equal pay? No, get yourself elected and make sure that we have it.
Thanks to all of my guests who have been invaluable in helping me create this podcast through their lengthy interviews and their research they shared with me. Special thanks to Meredith Machen with the League of Women Voters of New Mexico, who supplied me with a wealth of historical information, including articles by historian Joan Jensen from New Mexico State University. Finally, a huge shout out to my executive producer, Kevin McDonald, with New Mexico PBS, who encouraged me to create this podcast, and to all of you who found us and passed the word and shared the links. You can find all 4 episodes of New Mexico and the Vote on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts, as well as at nmpbs.org. We've got more resources there and links with more information, including details on commemoration events planned this year. And at that site, you can also stream the American Experience documentary, The Vote, which was the inspiration for this podcast. Major funding for American Experience provided by Liberty Mutual Insurance, Consumer Cellular, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Major funding for The Vote provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. Additional funding for The Vote provided by the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, Investing in Our Common Future, and by the Barbara Lee Family Foundation Fund. Additional funding for American Experience provided by the Robert David Lyon Gardner Foundation, the documentary Investment Group. Group and by public television viewers. American Experience is produced for PBS by WGBH Boston.